Well, so far, the markets have climbed a wall of worry. The economy has remained fairly resilient, and it appears as if the banking crisis may be behind us. At least that's what Wall Street is betting on, including either a no landing or soft landing scenario. Joining us on the show today to discuss all this for our Smart Macro segment is Chris Poplava, CIO of Financial Sense Wealth Management. So, Chris, what do you think investors should be anticipating over the second half of 2023?
Well, clearly, Chris, the economy has remained stronger than initially thought. It does appear that the markets have been climbing that wall of worry. But I think the key question to zero in on is, are we not going to have a recession, or are we? And if you're in the recession camp, then you have to ask yourself a question. Are we going to have the first time in history in which the stock market bottomed before the recession began, rather than during, as it has since the Great Depression? Every recession since the Great Depression, the markets bottomed during the recession, not before it. So, you know, you'd have to basically make the argument that this time is different, that the market did bottom before a recession, or you have to make the call that the most aggressive tightening by the central bank since Paul Volcker's days in the late 70s, early 80s will not lead to a recession. So that's a kind of a tall order. But essentially, that's kind of what you have to argue, is either no recession or we're going to have a first time in history in which the market bottomed before the onset of a recession. And I still feel that we do have a recession ahead of us. And if it's ahead of us, then that means the bottom's not in my opinion, if we follow the historical precedent. And I don't see any reason why we wouldn't. But I do think that we've kind of had essentially the market reaction last year was kind of just getting rid of some of the, in my opinion, the excess that we had prior to the peak. So the huge run-up, kind of blow-off move, we kind of gave a lot of that back. That excess sentiment and fervor in the market and greed, I think, was run out by a sharply increase in interest rates, which kind of brought down valuations to more normal levels versus nosebleed levels. But it wasn't really a response to a collapse in corporate profit margins, which typically happens during an economic downturn, or just an outright collapse in profits, not just profit margins. That typically is created by a economic downturn. So if we didn't have that benign phase of low interest rates, or, you know, really the interest rates should have been rising in 2021 by the Fed, if they would have kind of responded at an appropriate time to the rise in inflation, I don't think the market would have run up as much as it did. Then we probably wouldn't have had as much of a nasty 2022 year for the markets. So if you can kind of, you know, forget that part of it, but really zero in on what lays ahead, you know, collapse in corporate profit margins, a collapse in overall revenue, then you could clearly kind of make the argument that the market really hasn't had its bear market yet. It's bear market economic decline, which I think lays ahead still. And I think what we've seen is a real washed out sentiment, a couple of other factors that we saw late last year that really got pushed to an extreme have largely kind of reverted to the mean and moved in the opposite direction. And to me, I think this process since the bottom late last year, I would liken it more in terms of the, you know, kind of being in the eye of a hurricane, that this is essentially the calm before the storm, and the storm being the full force brunt hit to the economy caused by monetary policy and the rise in interest rates. We do know that, studying history, that monetary policy acts with a lag. Sometimes it hits with a 1 year, sometimes it hits with a 2 year. And just think of it from the standpoint, you know, let's say you took out a loan last year, or let's say even in 2021, you took out a 2 or 3 year car lease. Well, let's say, you know, the 2 year, 3 year leases are coming due, or you have a home equity which has a floating rate component to it. Well, you know, as these loans mature and they have to be refinanced, or you turn in your lease car and you go to lease a new one or purchase a new vehicle, there's all these different loans, you know, furniture loans. You know, when we first came out of 2020, interest rates were low. You could get a low interest rate on a, you know, a furniture loan or personal loan for any kind of purchase, or, you know, even recreational vehicles. Interest rates were a lot lower. So it was affordable. But now think about what it costs to finance consumption at current interest rates. I saw a statistic recently that RV sales have absolutely collapsed to one of the lowest year-over-year declines that we've seen in decades. And that makes sense. That's a big ticket item, highly, highly discretionary. And now the financing cost of a purchase like that is significantly higher than where it was, you know, a few years ago. This is why there's that lag. It's because as loans reset, and it's not just a consumer. Think of commercial real estate loans. Think of obviously residential loans or even corporate loans. You know, corporations are always issuing debt and they have debt maturing, they're reissuing debt. Even the U.S. government, you know, is seeing a real pickup in its interest expense. So that's why there's a lag when you feel the impact of it. So, for example, if the Fed just raised a quarter a point interest rate once every 6 months or 12 months, well, you're not really going to feel that, right? I mean, because you could have a loan mature and it's not that much different than where it was in the year before. But imagine if you basically go from zero to 500 basis points. I mean, that's a huge jump in a rapid amount of time. So as all the different economic actors of the economy, as they have their debt mature or refinancing, it's a huge sticker shock. And that's why there's that lag. So think about it. I mean, really, the Fed didn't start raising till a little over 12 months ago. So we really should just now be starting to enter into the full lagged impact of the Fed interest rate cycle. And, you know, the Fed raised rates not just too long ago. Yeah, they skipped in June, but they raised in May. So that impact of that hike won't be felt until, you know, at least 2024. So the impact of interest rate hikes by the Fed are going to be with us until next year. So to basically make the argument that we're not going to have a recession, you really have to say that the lagged impact of monetary policy out of nowhere in this cycle versus all the other cycles we've seen shrank to virtually instantaneous, that the market has already discounted everything and that we're already kind of through that window. I just don't see that, Chris. History doesn't support that. And I still think we have the full force of the aggressive hiking campaign by the Fed ahead of us. And remember, and a lot of people are just so fixated on interest rates and in the pause or pivot. The Fed's still shrinking its balance sheet. There's absolutely no hint, no conversation whatsoever about a pivot regarding quantitative tightening. That's still with us, and there's no sign that that's going to be turned around anytime soon. So, I mean, a true Fed pivot is when they're done tightening, and they're not. Maybe they're done tightening with interest rates, but certainly not when it comes to their balance sheet, which is the other side of the monetary policy. And let's just assume that the Fed is done. Well, look across the pond. I mean, we've got the Bank of England, we have the ECB, we have the Bank of Canada, the Bank of Australia, all these other developed central banks, they're still in hiking mode. And some of them were on pause, thought they were, but core inflation keeps remaining high and elevated, and they've been forced to go back towards hiking. So we can still feel the influence of the global hiking cycle, where what central banks are doing across the pond, pushing their sovereign bond yields higher, can influence our yields higher, just as we all kind of influence each other on the way down. It's the same way on the way up. So, you know, I don't see a major pivot where all of a sudden now we're dealing with monetary stimulus, or that we have some huge fiscal package coming to have additional fiscal stimulus to really kind of turbocharge the next phase of the economic growth cycle. And I still think we're in the deceleration, or in fact, recessionary phase of the economy.
Yeah, and speaking of Fed rate hikes and the aggressive tightening that we saw since last year, it's been about 15 months approximately since their first rate hike. It was really this week that we saw the Fed double down on this tightening, right? Because in the pause last week, that was considered a hawkish pause, because even though they paused for June, they did say that according to their dot plot, that the majority of Fed governors are lining up for two more rate hikes this year. In which case that would be a hawkish, that is leaning towards more tightening stance on monetary policy. So the market was basically disbelieving the Fed, that is something that we should expect, keeping higher for longer, which is what you're discussing here. And the Fed reiterated that view this week with this higher for longer stance that, hey, the market, Wall Street needs to accept that We are intent on wringing inflation out of the economy, and we're not seeing that when we look at that core sticky part of the CPI, which is remaining higher than we need. We want to get it down to that 2% level, and it's not happening quick enough. The market is, you know, on a sugar rush with this AI frenzy. So that means, you know, Wall Street is basically not getting the message according to the Fed's view as well. So I think, like you said, yeah, this higher for longer, having to borrow, whether or not that's for homes, for autos, all of these different things, the lifeblood of the economy, which is lending and borrowing, that's going to remain high. The cost of borrowing is going to remain high, and eventually that is going to have that deflationary impulse that the Fed is attempting. We just haven't yet seen that, or at least Wall Street is ignoring that for now, it seems like.
And you can kind of understand why, you know, this is. I mean, there have been some supports to the markets and the economy that pushed off, in my opinion, those dark clouds to make some feel that, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel. They're looking ahead. I think the light is not the tunnel. I think the tunnel's looking up, and that's, you know, in the eye of a hurricane, not, you know, coming out of a tunnel, so to speak. A lot of those supports, though, Chris, that were with the market since, you know, late fall to early winter last year, they've shifted and now gone in the opposite direction, yet the market is disconnected itself. A good example of that is money supply. You know, money makes the world go round. And when there's more money sloshing around the system, it can lead to more buyers than sellers and bid prices higher. Well, when we look at global money supply, so just kind of looking at all the different money supplies of the major economic zones, and if you price those in dollars, given most transactions are done in dollars, you can kind of get a general sense of global money supply. And when we look at the growth rate, I mean, it just skyrocketed post-COVID. I mean, it reached a level we hadn't seen before of nearly or just over a 25% annual growth rate in 2021. And that's more or less when valuations peaked. It's when essentially small caps stopped kind of making forward progress. The, you know, riskier areas of the market, such as non-profitable tech, or think of, you know, Cathie Wood's famous ARK fund, you know, that also peaked in early 21. And eventually the markets themselves peaked late 21 to early 22. But overall, the peak in the S&P's trailing 12-month PE ratio, or price earnings ratio, that was more or less right around the peak of money supply growth. And as money supply began to slow down and turn outright negative late last year, we saw valuations compress and we saw the market struggle. And though we did reach a negative annual growth rate in global money supply in the fall, that bottomed, and we actually saw it increase to a plus or minus, let's say, 4 to maybe a 5% annual growth rate. We saw that into, I would say, roughly April or May. But since April or May, with the bottom in the dollar stabilized since February, it has not made a new low. The global money supply year-over-year rate of change has actually now turned negative again. And while it looked just like the S&P's PE ratio, there's been a major divergence where it's going south while the market valuation or S&P PE ratio is going up. So that divergence was a support for the market, is no longer. And now we see kind of the market disconnected from money supply growth. So I think that's no longer a favorable development. I think that was part of the eye of the hurricane, so to speak, when money supply went from, you know, negative growth rate to a positive. It's now back to negative. So I think that support is now gone. One other really big one, Chris, and this is huge, and it's a little counterintuitive, and I've talked about it a few times with you on the podcast before, but when the Fed's printing money, you know, they go out and they buy treasuries or they go out and buy mortgage-backed securities. When we think of those are purchases that basically go under the Fed's assets of its balance sheet. But when the Fed is shrinking its balance sheet, we know that it's shrinking or letting kind of roll off its balance sheet, the treasuries, mortgage-backed securities as it mature. But it's really the liability side where you need to focus to find out what the liquidity impact is going to be on the markets. For example, one of the liabilities on the Fed's balance sheet is a reverse repo facility. And when that increases, that's essentially money being drained from the financial system because it effectively is out of the financial system. No one lends on it. You can't borrow on it or leverage that. The Fed doesn't lend on that. It's literally out of the system. And that was a huge thing we saw really kind of take off in 21 going to 22 was a surge in the reverse repo facility. And when that reverses, that is money getting back put into the economy or the financial system. So that's a positive. The other big factor on the Fed's liability side is the U.S. Treasury's general account at the Fed. Think of it like the Treasury's checking account. Well, your asset is another person's liability. So the Treasury's asset, basically the funds in that account, is the Fed's liability. And if you think about it, if that liability is falling, that means the government is spending money, injecting it into the economy, which is positive. And the opposite happens. If that builds, then that money is not going into the economy. That's just sitting on the Fed's balance sheet. So essentially, you know, that's a problem where when that rises, that's taking liquidity away. And when it falls, that's adding liquidity. Kind of the last third major piece on the Fed's liability side are bank reserves at Federal Reserve banks across the country. And there's a direct correlation between the level of bank reserves and the level of the stock market. You know, as bank reserves rise, that money is injected in the system, the stock market rises, and when the stock market falls, we tend to also see bank reserves fall. So we know the Fed is, let's just use round numbers, is selling roughly $100 billion in assets a month. Well, it matters what liability is falling. And what we saw this year was essentially since last fall, the Treasury's general account at the Fed fell by, I think, around roughly $600 billion. And that essentially injected money into the system, and that more than offset what we saw in the decline in the Fed's asset side. And conversely, we have seen over the last month a decline in the reverse repo facility as money market funds move from overnight Fed repos to buying T-bills with this huge surge. So as those two liabilities have fallen, that has actually allowed bank reserves to rise by over $300 billion this year. And again, as I mentioned, bank reserves are highly correlated to the market. So as perverse as this sounds, the Fed is shrinking its balance sheet. The net impact is actually felt like the Fed is doing quantitative easing, printing money, not tightening, because bank reserves have risen. And the reason for that, again, is the massive decline in the Treasury's account at the Fed due to the debt ceiling. It ran that kind of cash surplus account down, and the recent decline in the reverse repo facility, it's allowed bank reserves to rise as if the Fed was printing money again, which it's not. It's just a shift in composition of its liability. So what you have to ask yourself is, that support, will it continue? And my answer is probably not. The reason why is essentially the Treasury account at the Fed became roughly more or less zero as they exhausted that. And we know that the Treasury wants to increase that to over $500 million in the coming months. So that's a liability at the Fed that is going to be rising. Now, the key will be what happens with reverse repos. If reverse repos decline more than the Treasury accounts rise at the Fed, that kind of offsets that, so that's not an issue. And if it falls beyond that, well, then that can help to offset the decline in the Fed's asset side. But the question is, what if it doesn't? If the reverse repo facility does not fall, and if the Treasury's account at the Fed rises, then that means kind of the swing factor needs to be bank reserves to match the decline in the assets. And that's a real key. And so far this month, from what I saw, an estimate that I think roughly 85% of the surge in Treasury issuance has been in T-bills. Well, money market funds, which predominantly make up the bulk of the reverse repo facility assets, when they move, and they can move those reverse repos and buy money markets, that decreases the reverse repo facility. But what money market funds cannot do is buy longer dated government securities. So they can't buy 2, 5, 10, or 20 year notes and bonds by the US Treasury. So I think what we're going to see is a shift in the composition of Treasury issuance to beyond T-bills. Then that means this absorption of this tsunami, which the money market funds through the reverse repo facility have absorbed, may not be absorbed, and we actually might feel that loss in liquidity. So that's something I'm watching very closely, Chris, is to see what happens with bank reserves, how fast the Treasury's account at the Fed rises, and what the decline in reverse repo facility is going to be. But as I mentioned to you, that support, that massive, over $600 billion injection by the Treasury, that's now playing in reverse. That's going to be rising to over $500 trillion in the coming months. So that support's gone. It's just a key question on the reverse repo facility, what happens there. So I still think the liquidity headwind that we have, which we haven't felt yet, I still think is going to be felt in the coming weeks and months here and could certainly impact the markets.
You know, putting all this together, something that we've discussed numerous times on our show over the past few months and this year is the fact that, I mean, if we just look at it, leading economic indicators are continuing to fall. The Fed is still tightening, like you discussed today, and banks around the U.S. are still tightening up on lending. So when you put those three things together, I mean, that's really lining up for high odds that we're not going to just see a soft landing or a no landing scenario, but those are really lining up for a hard landing recession. Now, with that, like you said, you know, the economy has remained a bit more resilient than expected because of a lot of the consumption that we've seen, consumers still able to spend down some of those stimulus payments, although we are seeing credit card balances make new record highs at the same time. So there's a big question mark on the longevity of that.
That is another thing that's kind of supported the economy is the fiscal stimulus that we've had with the Inflation Reduction Act. I mean, that was a positive for the economy, kind of kicking it afloat. But as we've learned, the government spending is going to be capped for a few years here. So we're not going to see an increase. And again, growth is all about year over year, right? Is your net level higher than the prior year? What is your growth rate? And recession is a contraction in growth, not, you know, the level of growth. So if we're not going to get any more growth coming out of the government and possibly even a contraction, if you look at it from a year-over-year standpoint, you know, that support is gone. And that's kind of the point that I'm seeing and making is that a lot of the supports for the economy and the market are going to move to the wayside. So the moratorium on student debt payments, that's going to be gone in the coming months. So you're going to have to start spending money on debt servicing rather than consumption. So that's going to take away from the retail consumer. And speaking of leading economic indicators, Chris, or the odds of recession, we just got the May data for the Conference Board's leading economic index. And when we look at the actual index itself, its level has fallen for 14 straight months. I mean, essentially since the spring of last year, every monthly reading has been lower than the prior month. So that is a huge, steep decline, and a decline of this magnitude has never been seen outside of a recession. So, you know, again, on that call, whether we're going to have a no landing or no recession at all, I think is really premature and not likely. And when you overlay the Conference Board's LEI versus the S&P 500, for example, very rarely do they diverge from each other. And if they do, it's only short term. And when you look at the Conference Board's LEI, it literally peaked more or less plus or minus 1 month from the S&P in early 22. But we've seen a massive divergence since the fall, where the market has rallied, while we've seen just a consistent decline in the Conference Board's LEI. And we've seen some temporary divergences like this. I would say probably the most recent one where it was falling, the LEI was falling while the market shrugged it off, was in the late 80s to early 1990s. There was a period for which the stock market kept going up, and yet the LEI was rolling over. But eventually, we did land into recession. And once we were in recession, we had that 1990-91 recession in which the stock market did fall. But it did diverge for a while, but someone's going to have to play catch up, you know, whether the stock market moves down or the Conference Board's LEI moves up. And in most often, it's the case in which the stock market plays catch up to the downside versus the LEI rising to the upside to follow the market. So I think this temporary divergence of which we're seeing, I think it's going to be resolved by the market heading south rather than the LEI heading north.
And for those of you that would like to look at a visual of the divergence that we're talking about that Chris just mentioned between the Conference Board's leading economic index and the S&P 500, we'll post a chart of that where this interview is located at Financial Sense. Well, Chris, let's tie this into what we're seeing with the trading action in the market. If we look at the S&P 500 on the day that you and I are speaking, June 22nd, the S&P is trading at around 4378. It's pulled back slightly from that 4450 high that it got to for this year. And clearly, we got to overbought levels in the short term. If you just look at technical indicators, sentiment, what do you think we should expect from here?
Well, look at what happened last year. We saw a surge in all types of volatility, you know, volatility in currency trading, stock trading, bond trading, you know, across the board. And there's, you know, it's important to kind of know, you know, who the different players are and how they respond to different environments. And what we have are, you know, systematic positioning funds, essentially risk parity funds like Bridgewater's all-weather fund, vol-controlled funds or volatility-controlled funds, CTA-type funds, and they tend to basically amplify market volatility. So when volatility picks up, they reduce their position size, meaning they sell into a weak market if the VIX or volatility index for the market, as well as the volatility indices for the other asset classes, are rising. And so they were essentially selling into the lows of last year. Now, they got to a really low positioning level on various asset classes, and as volatility has collapsed this year, that has forced them to increase their position sizing. So they've been a decent support for the market, buying the market as it goes up. But when you look at data from Goldman Sachs, they're more or less almost fully invested. I mean, they're at least at the biggest positioning or longest long positioning level since, I would say, late 21 to early 22. So in terms of positioning by major institutional systematic players of the market, that support has largely been spent. I think really there's not much more upside for them given how low volatility indices have gotten. I really don't see them going to zero. So I don't think that is a support for the market anymore, which it was back in the late fall. And the other one, Chris, is sentiment. I mean, you look at sentiment levels across the board late last year, they were incredibly bearish. And when you look at where things are now, there's lots of different sentiment, whether you're looking at the AAII or the NAIM survey of active investment managers. You know, across the board, you're seeing a much more of a frothy market in terms of sentiment. So I don't think sentiment is a favorable checkmark for the bulls. I don't think positioning by institutional players is any longer a tailwind. I think that could actually be a headwind. So, you know, those two supports, sentiment and institutional positioning, are gone, in my opinion. I don't think we'll support the market going forward from here.
So, Chris, as always, it's a pleasure to have you on our show to get an update on what we're seeing with this divergence between the market data and the economic data. On that note, would you mind telling our listeners about some of the services that we provide here at Financial Sense Wealth Management?
Sure. We provide a whole host of financial services. We provide financial planning, wealth management. We also do 401k servicing, consulting, and we also assist corporations in managing their cash balance.
If any of our listeners would like to get in touch with our financial advisors, what would be the best way to do so?
They can give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you again on Smart Macro. We look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.